This is Radical Love Live, an ongoing series of podcasts and special events where we explore faith outside the boxes. Hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson.
Hey, Kelly.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I am awesome as always. And how are you, my friend?
I am so good. Still on vacation down here in the Outer Banks, but glad to be in by remote.
Exactly. I was going to say you're phoning it in, but that has a connotation in of itself.
Exactly,
but you are not phoning it in. You're actually doing this high tech. So
indeed.
The beauty of internet and our platform here. It's good to see you again. I hope you and your family are enjoying your deserved holiday there on the Outer Banks. And so record another episode of Radical Love Live. So
indeed.
What are we talking about today, my friend?
Today we have a guest. Austin Hartke is with us here. And he's the founder of Transmission Ministry Collective, an online community dedicated to the spiritual care, faith formation, and leadership potential of transgender and gender expansive Christians. And he's also the author of Transforming, which is a book that has been incredibly helpful for me, that is subtitled The Bible and the Lives of Transgender Christians. So Austin, welcome. We're so glad to have you here today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Hey, Austin. So yeah, thanks. Great. We're like, super excited to have you on board with us. Kelly, do you have any questions you'd like to start off with, Austin?
Yeah. And we're gonna dive right into this. And the political climate today, transgender people are really in the spotlight. All of a sudden, it's heartbreaking to see how politicians, conservative politicians in particular, are targeting transgender people and especially kids. And one of the questions for me and probably for our audience is, why do you think that they've chosen this moment to focus on trans people?
Yeah, it's really, like you said, it's tragic and it's also surprising. I think that kids have always been one of the main ways that people motivate society to care about stuff is like the children are the future and we protect the children. Yes. And things like that. And that's always been one way of mobilizing people, whether it's around like fear or protectiveness or however it shows up. But it's rare when you have people who are actively campaigning or saying things that will harm kids. And I think the main crux of the conversation is that the people who are saying these things and putting forward legislation that harms transgender kids are doing it because they think they're trying to protect those kids. At least the people that are doing it in good faith think that they're trying to protect kids. But there are plenty of people that are not doing it in good faith.
So all that out. Yeah.
So the kind of, I think the reason that trans folks have become such a political football is because we're a very small group of people. And I think folks who historically, for instance, were really opposed to same gender marriage and things like that, realized that they lost that battle and they needed a new political football. And so trans people have just become the new focus, the new scapegoat for everything that's wrong. There's a really interesting poll that Fox News did back in April. And it's just interesting that this is from Fox News, right? But they did a poll and they asked about what issues people were concerned about. And one of the things that the poll showed was that about 80% of respondents said that they thought people were going too hard on transgender kids, which is interesting. That's even within the Fox News world. There are people that are like, y'all are going too far. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that it said was it asked people, what's your main concern right now? And only 1% of respondents said anything about trans folk being a main concern. What we're seeing on the ground in our communities is that trans folks are not in as much of a panic as media would have you believe, but we as a community are a really convenient scapegoat for people to use. And so it's really the squeaky wheels, the people that are the loudest that keep talking about us are misrepresenting what I think society as a whole feels.
Yeah, well said. And can I follow on with that, Austin? Is there also deliberate whether it is deliberate, a conflation of trans with also what we see with going on with the drag queen story hours as well? Mm-hmm. There was just, if it's the man in the dress phenomenon as well and painting of that, and you and your entire community, of which we're all a part of as a queer community, are you being caught up into this as well? Because it seems like that the story hour thing has become a hot one for a few folks as well.
I think the story hour thing has become as big as it has because it directly involves kids. And right. So you probably remember this, Mark, like in the 80s and the 90s, even gay people were seen as a danger to children. And that was how it was set up. It's the exact same thing today with trans folks, with drag queens being set up as we are a danger to children, which is just so unbelievably untrue. And it sucks that we're falling for it again, because it's the exact same rhetoric that was used against gay and lesbian folks in the 70s, 80s. So it's really the way that things are being implemented and legislation is being implemented is really about policing people's gender expression, whether that's for trans folks or drag queens or whoever. And many folks who do drag are trans and many aren't, right? That's part of our community too. But it's really all about policing people's gender expression and how we are allowed to show up in the world. And I think a lot of cisgender folks or non-transgender folks don't realize that this is affecting them too and is going to continue to affect them, because we've seen more and more people, like women who maybe have short hair and dress in a more masculine way, but who are not trans and who are cisgender, who are not even maybe gay, are being kicked out of restrooms because people are like, you shouldn't be in here. So this is affecting cisgender people too. The more we police how people are allowed to present their gender in public, the more it's going to affect everybody. And I think people don't quite realize that.
All said. Wow. To that end, there was a recent piece that I read from a woman who was in Europe, and she was chased out of the restroom. And this was in France, as I believe. Yeah. Because the restroom attendant, which as folks know, in some of the throughout Europe, you'll have attendants. And the woman thought she was a man and called management, and it was like turned out to be an ado when here she is cisgender. She happens to be lesbian, but that's not even the point. Mm-hmm. They identified her as being too masculine because she had a suit. And I was like, oh my God, is this and to your point, is this as a result of all of this hyper awareness that we must fit these boxes of what we look like in how we represent ourselves? And God forbid that a woman has on, I don't know, a masculine looking outfit.
Yeah. And it becomes something where we finally, I know it's like second wave feminism. Like we've broken out of some of these senses of, okay, men can't be stay at home dads and women can't have careers. And like, we've broken out of some of these things, and we've broken out of some of the men can have long hair and it's fine. Women can have short hair and it's fine. We've broken out of these molds, and now we're being shoved back into them because of the people that are like, no. Women have to look like this and men have to look like this, and it's going to affect everybody. It's not something that just is a problem for trans folks.
Despite the fact that a lot of the folks, like the men in the Bible, probably wore gowns and had long hair.
Gender expression is entirely culturally constructed in terms of how we understand what men look like and what women look like. And yeah, the folks that are like traditional masculinity, what traditional masculinity, where and when? You have to be specific because it's different everywhere and in every time.
Right. Was it in the Victorian era where pink was regarded as a masculine color and that?
Oh,
because blue is too soft, so blue was feminine.
Yep, exactly. So for a long time, and then we just decided it had to be different. And it's funny how we can just decide things have to be different, and people don't understand how much of gender expression specifically is culturally created.
Yeah, that leads me to another question. And my friend base spans the spectrum theologically from very progressive mainline folks to very conservative evangelicals. And talking about transgender people, I've run into some conservative people who say, well, it's just the Bible says that it's not right, or something to that effect. And it's not necessarily that the Bible clearly defines these gender roles. And that's one of the things reading Transforming, talking about the Ethiopian eunuch and some of these other examples in the Bible. And I was just wondering if you could start to address a little bit of that, like what you wish Christians knew about being trans and being Christian.
Yeah, I think one of the sort of pitfalls we can often fall into is thinking that Christianity as a tradition is something like we basically think about Christianity in the United States since like 1900. And we think that's what Christianity is. And we ignore the fact that we've got several thousand years, a couple thousand years of tradition before that and all over the world. And so when we fall into the, okay, this is what so often Christians who, for instance, are not in favor of same sex, same gender marriage, right? They will say, I have a traditional view of marriage, right? And they use that word traditional, and we use the word traditional when people talk about, I believe in traditional gender roles for men and women. It's, what do you mean by traditional? Do you mean in the US since 1900? Because that's usually what they mean. Most of the time, they mean in the US since 1950. We have a huge amount of history that includes trans and gender expansive people, both within, I would argue, within the Bible. We see people that are outside of the bounds of gender, as we might expect what that looks like to be today. And then throughout Christian history, there's a number of saints. If you're within the Catholic tradition or a tradition that pays attention to saints, there's a number of saints who lived their whole lives in a gender different from the one that they were assigned at birth. And they're like a part of our story too. And so one thing I wish Christians knew is that we have the sense of what Christianity is so much bigger than you first think. There's so much more to the story. There's so much more to our history. And because trans and gender expansive people have been with us throughout human history, it's not surprising that they pop up in our scriptures and in our history, because we've been here the whole time.
But thank you for that. That's very well said. Yeah. One of my comebacks sometimes when I'm talking to, particularly when I'm talking to men from a conservative faith, is talking about how in Revelation, we become the bride of Christ. And watching the wheels turn. Oh, no, that's a metaphor.
Yeah. No, the interesting gender metaphors that happen in terms of like Israel and God and the church and God throughout Old Testament or Hebrew Bible and New Testament scriptures, there's a definite sense of some of the things that Paul wrestles with is this idea of what does it mean as to be the bride of Christ if you are a man in the world that you currently exist in? And yeah, there's a lot of interesting gender stuff happening there that we don't often touch.
And then he goes on, Paul goes on to say, you know, in Christ, there is no male or female. There is no Jew or Greek. All the lines get. Another thing that kind of shifts from more theological to practical is that one of the targets right now is specifically gender affirming therapy for kids. And when it gets to involving the stage where it's involving puberty blockers or hormones, and that there are political voices that are opposed to this therapy. But then there are studies that show that gender-affirming therapy improves kids' mental health, and that the rates of, people talk about regret, is that the rates of regret are actually quite low. What are some things that you would say to someone who is concerned about gender-affirming therapy?
I think I would want to talk with them about what they're concerned about, like what their concerns are. If somebody, for instance, is under the impression that like kids are having surgery related to gender, I can tell them that's not actually happening.
Right.
What's happening. The only thing that happens for kids is like for young folks is like social transition. And we only get to medical options in terms of puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones as they get older to keep them on track with their peers. And so I would want to talk to them about what their concern is, right? Is their concern for, I think it's funny because I think what people often underneath things, what people are often concerned about is both bodily autonomy and like kids' ability to make decisions that are going to be good for them in the long term, right? Yeah. They're worried about whether kids really know who they are at a young age. And so can they make those informed decisions, right? And those are not bad concerns to have, right? It's good to be concerned about bodily autonomy. It's good to be concerned about whether people are making choices that will benefit them in the long term. If that's where they're coming from, then we are on the same team. And I think it's good to start with that. If that's what the concern is, we can be on the same team about that. But I think where it becomes tricky is when people are like this 14-year-old that they don't actually know who they are and they can't make good decisions about themselves. It's true that kids need guidance, right? But it's also true that kids know a lot more about themselves than we give them credit for. And when I think we think about young folks and how they understand themselves, we discount the fact that they have often done a lot of wrestling and a lot of thinking about things before we as adults ever hear about it, which is why one of the main myths out there right now is this idea of rapid onset gender dysphoria, this idea that like kids can just show up with this suddenly.
And right.
All those studies, the two studies that were done that tried to say that rapid onset gender dysphoria was a thing have been debunked a bajillion times. We can put that to rest. But in those cases, basically, it was parents saying, wow, my kid came up with this out of nowhere, and I'm so surprised, and it seems so sudden. And it's when we actually talk to the kid, no, the kid has been thinking and talking about this and exploring this and maybe even known this about themselves for years. But of course, they didn't tell parents. They didn't talk to adults about it. Either they didn't have the language or they didn't think they would be listened to. So I think trusting kids is really important, but guiding them in a way that allows them to make good decisions is good. But I don't think there's a point at which we say you're 16 and you don't know enough about yourself and the world yet to be able to make decisions about your body. If we let kids at 18 sign up to go into the military and get shot, I think we have to talk about what we're talking about when we talk about letting people make their own decisions about their bodies.
Right. It seems like a lot of those folks have forgotten what it's like. What it was like for them, like when they were a teenager, they knew who they were. But just a couple generations back, teenagers were getting married and homeowners and parents and whatnot. Mark, I see you, I know you've got a list of questions. I see you leaning into the mic there. So,
no, I just, everything you said, Austin, is just resonates deeply, because being a cisgender gay man, what you were just sharing with the rapid onset, that would be, it's very similar to what my coming out story would be. My parents were like, oh, I'm like, no, I've been thinking about this for a long time. It's just something we didn't talk about. And that happens time and again, because the kid, this person, whether it's me or anybody, we're all thinking through this, of course. We're not going to tell our folks. Right. Maybe more so in current generations, if we have cool parents, not that I didn't. The culture is, that we just don't talk about things that are not easy conversations. We've already internalized and processed a lot of that. So that's
right.
Why it's
and I, so much. Yeah. And it's not like when kids, even if it feels sudden for the parents, it's not like the kids say, hey, I'm trans and I want to do this thing, and they immediately go do it. That's not how the process works. Even within informed consent clinics, which are like, informed consent is a has fewer hoops to jump through than maybe other ways of doing things have. But even within informed consent, there's still a lot of hoops you have to jump through in order to do anything medical. And so there's, I think people think, I tell my parents I'm trans today and I'm at the clinic getting hormones tomorrow. And that's not how that works either. So we have to educate people about what transition timelines can look like and what transition can look like for young folks. And there's just so much misinformation out there. It's hard to get the actual information to people.
Wow.
Right. Sure. Yeah. It seems like a lot of people see people like rushing to the clinic, where even something like puberty blockers is often used to put the pause button on so that we can all think about this and make sure that you were talking about this and making sure that the decisions are solid and the identity is solid. And I don't think opponents to that kind of therapy understand that everybody's trying to be as thoughtful and careful as they can, because the kid's health is paramount.
Yeah, it's true. And the people that argue about there's a huge rate of regret, there's actually not. The rate of regret is like 2% or something like that. And compared to the rate of regret for knee surgery is like 30%. So are we telling people they can't get knee surgery? No, that's not how this works.
Well said, Austin. It's great to have you a part of this conversation. You're so well-spoken about through your own experiences. And I'm going to change it up a little bit and talk about what you would describe as your call. You are a theologian yourself, right? You went to seminary and you're ordained, right?
No, my degree track was the academic track rather than the ministry track. And then I ended up doing ministry anyways.
And we're all ministers, aren't we?
That's what Luther said. That's what Luther said, that it's the communion of people all ministering together.
That's what we are. And it sounds like you have a joyful ministry especially living through your own experiences. So tell us a little bit, what is it that you do working within church communities and addressing so much of the conversation that we just had? Because I got to imagine this is a big conversation, a big topic.
Definitely. Yeah. A lot of the work that I do with churches these days is really, it's interesting because I started doing this work, education work with churches in 2015. And so 2015, 16, 17, it was mostly conversations about Trans 101. They really hadn't heard much about trans folks. And we really got to, in many ways, we still had to deal with a lot of the transphobia that's just in our culture, that's low-lying, like the sense of especially transphobia against trans women or anybody that we think of as a masculine person that is presenting too feminine, quote unquote. We still had to deal with that stuff that's just in the water we swim in. But we didn't have to deal with all of the misinformation that's currently out there, right? And so the education work has really moved from sort of a 101, here's what it means to be trans, et cetera, all to today. A lot of the work that I do is combating misinformation. You've heard this, but here are the studies, right? And so that's changed some of what I do. But really, a lot of the churches I work with ask me to come teach there because they are churches who went through some sort of, there may be like a Reconciling in Christ church or an Open and Affirming church, or they've done work around sexuality and affirming gay, lesbian, bisexual, pansexual folks, but they haven't done that work for trans and gender expansive folks. And so they're realizing that they've only done part of the work. And so it's always funny to have conversations with churches in that spot because they're, oh, we got our stamp. Like, we're affirming, we got our stamp. Uh-huh. But how about trans folks, intersex folks, like other folks in the community, what about them? And they're like, oh, we haven't really done anything to educate about them. And I'm like, good, let me upgrade your stamp.
That's right.
So that's a lot of the work I do.
Oh, that's so awesome. I think you covered the fact that you're working within affirming and inclusive churches. Are these non-denominational or are they denominational that we know about as well?
Yeah, there's a range. I guess if I was going to break it down percentage-wise, the most churches that I speak to are probably Lutheran churches because that's the tradition that I come from, ELCA churches specifically. Sure. So Lutheran churches, Episcopal churches, Presbyterian churches, UCC churches, it's really all over the place. It's more rare that I get invited to non-denom churches, but it's not unheard of. And especially if it's like a congregational, if it's a church that allows for congregations to make their own decisions, they have a lot more freedom versus churches that have more of a polity that they have to go through the chain of command to make sure it's okay with the higher ups. So I have yet to speak at a Southern Baptist church, but American Baptists, we got them. It's a little bit of everybody.
Great. What are so you answered that you've gone beyond Trans 101, right? Mm-hmm. And now you're into, my word here, battling misinformation, but I'm sure it does feel like a battle because it just this overwhelming focus on trans folks and using them as the enemy and othering. And of course, I look at it as monetizing othering as well, because that's what certain denominations, like the one you just happened to mention, like Southern Baptist by name, who demonize us, anybody that's in the queer community, because it doesn't fit their box of what they determined to be a good Christian. So God love you for the work that you do. And I mean that literally, God love you. The element of that though, what are other questions that come out? What would you like for me to have this conversation with somebody within my own church community? What would I, and I say this honestly as a gay man, what is it that biblically, what could I do in my own conversations, in my own space?
Yeah. In terms of practicing allyship with trans folks,
yes.
I think one of the things that I really thought for a long time in this work was that if I could just get the information to people, if I could just do the education work, it would change people's hearts and minds and how all that kind of stuff. And if I could just get them the information, they just don't know. That's not always the case. There are some people for whom you can give them all kinds of information and it's not going to change the way that they treat trans folks. And so I think one of the things that I've realized in continuing this work is that we can't go into it with the same sort of, what do I want to say? If you're somebody who grew up in an evangelical or had an evangelical background, you may have really been drilled in the process or structure of apologetics for Christianity, right? Like you're drilled into it. What if you have a friend who says, like, how can you believe that stuff? You're taught how to respond to that conversation.
Absolutely.
And so I think sometimes when queer Christians come up into these conversations about LGBTQ folks, we take that same tact. We're like, okay, cool. I'm going to use the same formula of apologetics to defend who I am as a queer person.
Right.
And it's a little bit of the, like, master's tools will never dismantle the master's house situation. But I worry that, like, the use of that structure of apologetics doesn't necessarily always help. And so one of the things that I've started trying to do is to, instead of coming to a conversation and being like, here's the evidence that I have, and then they say, here's what I think, and you just go back and forth and try to see who has better evidence, right, rather than doing it that way, I've been trying to figure out where the person is coming from and trying to get on their side first so that we can look at the problem together rather than looking at each other as the problem. So one of the things that's been really helpful for me is, and I talk about this a lot, so if folks have heard me talk about this a lot or before, that's why. What's been really helpful for me is a theological idea called the Wesleyan quadrilateral, which is just a square, right? That's just a quadrilateral. But this idea that there are four things through which we build our faith. It's scripture, tradition, reason, and experience. And those four things help inform our faith and our experience of faith. And there are people who rely really heavily on one of those four things. And there are people that are a little more balanced between those four things. If I'm coming to a evangelical church that is really Bible-focused, then I'm going to talk Bible with them. If I'm going to a Catholic church that's really tradition-focused, then I'm going to talk about Christian history. Trying to find where we can, like, where our common concern could be, and starting from there, rather than going in and being like, so I have these Bible stories and I can prove to you that this is a good thing, because often you just end up butting heads rather than trying to get on the same page first and then looking, if that makes sense.
Wow. Great response. Thank you. That question just came up in my mind and you answered it extremely well.
Once again, John Wesley gets name dropped in our podcast.
I'm a huge is this
Wesley
a common theme?
Fan. Yeah. You know, I come from a kind of a Wesleyan tradition. Yeah, he comes up a lot.
Yep.
Yes, he does. I'm going to ask you another question. So do you go outside of what are religious spaces? Do you get into LGBTQ centers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do some work here. I'm based in Minnesota. So I do some work with our state LGBT organization called Outfront Minnesota. And I work with them on some things. They have a faith arm. And so I often collaborate with them. And yeah, if there are, it's funny because you have to be, being a queer Christian of any stripe, going into faith spaces, you're often worried about blowback, the ill experience as a queer person. Going into queer spaces, it's not the same thing because you're not worried, or at least for me, I'm not worried about the sort of same, like the transphobia and things like that, right? I'm not worried about blowback in the same way. What I am worried about is I want to step very carefully, because so many people in our community have so much religious trauma that they're dealing with. And so when I come into queer spaces, I come in stepping carefully because of that. Not because I'm worried that they're going to respond negatively to me, although that does happen sometimes, but I know that it's happening out of pain. I know that it's not somebody who's pissed off because they think I'm not human. They're pissed off because they've been really hurt. And so that feels a lot easier to deal with. And so being very careful in queer spaces and knowing that my talking about faith in that space can bring up trauma for people that they might not be ready to address or look at, and that's okay. So I think it's a different kind of caution in each space, but it's something that's really important to be aware of when you walk in the door.
That's like, I'm going to follow on with that, if you don't mind, that from my own personal experience, somebody that's near and dear to me working on my own call with, along with me, yeah, he calls it unintegrated trauma, which it sounds, and you're absolutely right. To that end, there's a website that I follow that is, it's done by a gay man here in New York City. And he posts a lot about religion in that whenever there is somebody that's arrested or convicted for child abuse in a formal role as a youth minister or whatever role they might be. And that that fires up his readers. And I get it, because his point, the reason why he does that is in direct correlation that we are called predators or groomers. And he's, if we really are, then what are you doing here? So I get the basis of that. The point I'm getting at, though, is when I look at what's being put, some of the responses in the post, there was one where a few weeks ago, somebody had said, all Christians are predators. I could not let that one go. So I said, nope, that's not true. And so as a queer Christian myself, and I got flamed hard for that. Right. And just, I can't even, everything was thrown at me. And I thought, okay, I see the anger, and I had to process that. And it goes back to this unintegrated trauma. But that's why you ask about LGBTQ centers and getting into spaces where we're going to encounter our community who have been traumatized. And how do you engage them? What are you, like you said, you're going carefully, but there are folks out there hurt. And I feel that's part of my call. I'm sure it's yours as well. How do we help them?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the context in which you are talking with them. I think if, and also it's just really hard when you, like, especially in online space, when everybody, there's something to be said about the physicality of being a body in a space with other bodies that help you like regulate in many ways. And when we're talking separately in our own houses or apartments, that's a lot harder to do. But I think if I'm in a space, say I'm walking into an LGBT center and I'm talking with folks there, and I think this is, it's just also context-based, because if I'm walking into an LGBT center and there are queer folks there, they get to know that we're in their house, as opposed to inviting queer folks into a church in which they're like, oh, this is dangerous. Thinking about that context is really important. Making sure that the person who has experienced trauma is in a context in which they feel like they're in their house, so that they can come to the conversation from a point of stability, a point of protection, that they know that there are other people around them who will protect them. So again, that's really hard to do online because we have no idea where that person is in space.
I only use that as an example because I would not, but it was just anger. It was like,
Yep, absolutely. And I think there's one of the things that we run into, because Transmission Ministry Collective, we're an online community. And so all the work that we do is online. I should say all the work we do is online, except for we've recently started doing in-person meetups just for a couple of cities where we were like, okay, we're just going to have people where they can like see each other face to face, even though we mostly talk online. And anytime we have conversations with a group of queer Christians, there are some folks who are maybe they've been along sort of maybe a kind of deconstruction journey, or they're a little bit more knowledgeable about how that trauma has affected them. And there are other people who are still very much in a context that is hurting them, and the trauma hasn't really been addressed. And so we constantly run into this about, okay, we have one person who is really using a lot of like, the spirit led me and God told me and all this. And it's really triggering the other people in the room who are like, oh, I've been like prayed over and said, here's what God says about you. And so you have people in the same, whether it's a digital room or real room, who are like, oh, you're coming from very different perspectives here on this. How do we talk together without hurting each other? And that's just community. How do we be together without hurting each other? It's just community. And I think it's something that we have to deal with in almost every context. But it's especially hard when you know where that hurt has come from.
Well said. Thank you.
Going back to the Christian context, because I'm sure that there are some people that you talk to about faith who are just like, how can you still be allied with Christianity when it's our adversary? What are some of the, like, what is like the core of your, and this is very personal, your faith that you share? This is why I stumble. This is why I have stumbled on faith.
That's such a good question. I don't know if y'all are new about for a while, Rachel Held Evans and Nadia Bolz Weber had a convention called Why Christian. And that was the whole thing, is that they asked people to come and essentially answer the question, why are you still a Christian? Okay. And I think about Rachel's answer all the time at that first conference that they had. Rachel essentially said, I'm still a Christian because it's the story that I'm willing to be wrong about. And I just love that answer. That really still resonates with me. I think the center of my faith, it's a dual center. One is a center around a sense of history and belonging that comes from, I often think of like faith as something we borrow from our ancestors, that it's something that has been passed on and built upon. My favorite theologian, Abraham Heschel, said, there are no proofs for the existence of God. There are only witnesses. Mm-hmm. And I think about that all the time.
I'm all for Heschel. Thank you very much. You'll make people happy by him mentioning him.
Yeah. So I just feel like that sense of the witnesses, follow the witnesses, has been really important to me. The other thing that's really important, the other sort of dual piece of that, is theology around incarnation. The idea that God knows what it's like to experience life in a body is really fascinating to me. And Christianity is not the only religion for whom that is true. Hinduism has that. But specifically the story that I grew up with that talks about God, an embodied God, a God who chooses to be embodied and experience life as a human, is really powerful for me as somebody who wrestled for a long time with what it means to have a body and be a body. So I think those are the two bits, the witnesses and the embodiment and the incarnation, that are really important to me.
Thank you for that. Thank you for sharing. I know that's got to be very personal insight, but we appreciate that. And I'm looking at the time. I wish we could talk all day, but it looks like we're probably coming up on our time pretty soon. Mark, do you have any other last questions?
I do. I saw your YouTube. There's two questions here. What you did on YouTube with 100 different episodes that you recorded starting several years ago, mm-hmm. what it is to be trans and Christian. And it absolutely blew me away. And I'm saying to our listeners, if you've not seen it, go check it out, what you have done. Austin, I think it's so obvious. It's something I've thought about personally doing, but you actually did it. And do you keep that up? Is that still going on?
I'm trying to think. It was like 2014 to 2016 or 2017. So it was a short-term sort of project that I worked through. I started with like the main verses that are used against trans folks and started there, and then moved into, okay, what else can we say about what it means to be trans and Christian besides having to just debate the clobber passages over and over? Right. And so I started those videos because I came out of seminary and was working in a job that wasn't related to my degree. And I was like, what do I do with this? I really want to talk about this. And so I started making the videos because trans people at the time, like 2012 to 2014 or so, trans people were documenting their transitions on YouTube. And I was like, this is perfect. I'll just do it here. And then those videos became the basis for Transforming, the book I wrote. And so it's like the videos turned into the book, which turned into the Transmission Ministry Collective community. So it's a through line.
Oh my God, that's beautiful. All right. And I'm going to ask one other question. In your working with trans folks, how is their spirituality? Where do they fit in that spectrum? Do they perceive it as a gift? Or do you find them to be more spiritual? What's your sense of the individuals that you encounter?
I think it's just as diverse theologically as any other group of people. I think trans folks have a unique insight into, especially one of the things I talk about a lot is, and this is not my own idea, this came from Virginia Ramey Mollenkott, but talking about how trans folks have a insight into being able to break down the dichotomies and binaries that are so inherent in faith, in Christianity, specifically the sort of heaven, hell, good, evil, holy, unholy, body, spirit, like all of these dichotomies that Christianity is so entrenched in. Trans people can help recognize the places where it's a both and, or it's a neither. And so I think trans folks have a lot of spiritual insight into what it is to be a whole rounded spiritual person who doesn't have to rely on structures that we try to smash God into. What does God look like without those structures we tried to shoehorn God into? So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well said. Thank you very much for your time, Austin. You have been an awesome guest, and I'm so grateful that you joined us on another episode of Radical Love Live. Kelly, do you have anything else that you'd for Austin? Or?
No, I just want to say thanks. This has been an awesome conversation, and remind our listeners that Austin's book, Transforming, is available wherever you buy books. And you can also, can they find the TMC online?
They can. It's just transmissionministry.com.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. And thank you so much. We really got a lot out of this conversation. I hope our listeners do too.
I'm so glad. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Austin.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Radical Love Live, co-hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson. All rights reserved. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, and other popular podcast platforms. Go to RadicalLoveLive.com to learn more about us, watch recordings of our live events, and listen to our podcast. We also invite you to check out what Kelly and Mark are doing by going to our websites. Find Kelly at KellyWilson.com and Mark at MarkDilcom.com. This is Radical Love Live, where we explore faith outside the boxes.